Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and you're listening to episode 8 of season 6 of the GNU World Order. Okay, in this episode we're going to talk about a lot of stuff, actually. So much stuff that I'm going to even jot it down, because I've just got so much stuff to talk about. So we're going to talk about Text2PDF. It's a great little application that I ran across the other day. We're going to talk about a patch I wrote for screenplay.el, which was the screenplay mode for Emacs. That we discussed in the previous episode. We're going to talk about screenplay-tools, a really great set of line command tools to help an author and even a production staff, like the assistant director and stuff, process the script, analyze the script, print it out, get it out to PDF, and get reports from it, like location reports, character reports, stuff like that. We're going to talk about E17, or Enlightenment 17. Probably will mention the comic book podcast that I've been listening to lately still, and we'll talk about Doug, I don't know if I'm allowed to say his last name, so Doug's Python episode of HPR, and maybe talk about some Linux fests that are coming up. So just a really packed episode, so we should probably just jump right into it. Okay, so first let's just talk about Text2PDF. This is in no particular order. Text2PDF is a little C application. It's written in C. It's maybe, I haven't exactly looked at the word count to it, but it seems like it's a very short application. And actually, I could even find out just doing a WC space dash L on Text2PDF.c. Looks like it's 455 lines of code, and probably some of that's comments and everything. So it's a small little C application. I mean, obviously a lot larger of a C application than anything I've ever written, since I've written, let's see, I think 0 lines of C code so far is how much I've done. But it's a great little application that I found sort of by accident. I mean, it wasn't necessarily by accident, but I was looking for something that would translate plain text to PDF and do it very accurately, and kind of that's it. You know, just do one thing, as they say, and do it well, and that is to take my plain text document and translate it into a PDF. Don't do anything fancy, don't add anything, just do that. And well, wouldn't you know, Text2PDF is the exact thing that I needed. Text2PDF lives at some place called the Document Engineering Lab, which I guess is housed by the University of Nottingham, and it's the website is eprg.org, and then if you go to /pdf corner/text2pdf, and that's the number 2, of course, you'll find this little application. It's written by a guy named Phil Smith. There's a GNU make file, thankfully, by Nelson Beebe, and those two things make it marvelously easy to compile. If I had to specify a license for this, it would maybe be some kind of, honestly, I'm not even sure what it would be. There is no license that I could tell, except that it says you can distribute the binaries and the source code, but don't change anything without letting the author, Phil Smith, know. So I don't know what that would be like. I guess it would be sort of like a GPL-ish kind of thing, because you have to give notification, or you have to give it the code back, I presume. But anyway, it's not explicitly stated. But the application is super easy to compile and to use. You simply can wget the binary, the source, and the make file. As long as they're in the same folder, you can run the single command make, and in maybe 1 second, you'll have the executable binary, and that you can run by doing text2pdf input file redirect output file .pdf. And that's it. That's all you have to do. Suddenly your plain text file is just a line for line, character by character for character, PDF rather than plain text. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. It's very handy. It's one of those little applications that after I found it, I had to grab it, put it on my little USB drive of stuff that I never want to become separated from. You know, it's just that good. So check out Text2PDF by Phil Smith over at the Document Engineering Lab. So the next thing, speaking of code and how many lines of code I've ever written, this kind of almost makes me sound like I've written some code. So screenplay.el, which we talked at length about in the previous episode. Still great. I'm still completely in love with it. I'm very excited about it. I mean, it really is very liberating to have this screenwriting application that will run on anything that Emacs runs on. It's just really, really cool. I've been doing a lot with it, actually. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on this show previously, but I did, actually. I got a new job. So previously, I was doing part-time technical writing for some company, and just I was working in Emacs all day in XML, and it was really cool. Very educational. Not exactly very multimedia-centric, so, but it was good to be a paid writer for a little while. But now I'm doing a lot more multimedia stuff at this new job that I've got, and so I've been doing a lot of work with screenplay stuff, and being able to find screenplay mode for Emacs has literally changed the way that I work. It's just literally changed everything for me, so it's been really huge. So, you know, Vance L. Simpson, if you're out there listening anywhere, thank you, sir. Presumably he's not, because I did actually find that screenplay.el, one of the important things that it was missing were transitions. Now, transitions are these little things, these little words on the far right side of the page, and if you can find a screenplay, a real screenplay to look at, you'll see them. And they say things like fade in, cut to, dissolve, angle on, fade out, things like that. The interesting thing about these transitions are that they're not actually used as transitions these days. It's really just something that, it's a vestige of the old world of screenwriting, where people were actually writing in things like, we will place a fade in here, we will place a dissolve here, we will cut rather than dissolve here. So, I mean, it used to be very, very much a blueprint, and that's partly, I think, because, well, the screenwriters were more involved in the production of the, well, they were more and less involved. They were more in on how it was going to be produced, and they were far, far removed from the actual product. And optical effects back then were expensive. They had to be done on big machines and with celluloid, you know, and whether you were going to just cut or whether you were actually going to spend the time and money on a dissolve or a fade, those were actual concerns. Those were actual things that people needed to know. So they were written in very specifically at one point, but now they're actually just tradition. And one of the things that a screenplay reader is going to, you know, kind of looks for when they see a screenplay are the fade in and the fade out at the beginning and the end of the screenplay. It's weird. But if you see that, then you think, oh, okay, this person knows what they're doing. And if you don't see it, you get suspicious. You're like, this person's never written a screenplay before. They don't have the fade in or the fade out. It's weird. It's kind of like a, you know, an EOF at the end of the file or something. Or if you're looking at someone's HTML code, whether they actually close HTML or if they just rely on the quirk mode of the browser to figure out, oh, that's the end of the HTML document. Little things like that. So you've got transitions that are completely not needed and yet completely needed. Screenplay.el did not have anything for transitions. There was no function for transitions. And I realized that was a glaring hole in the system. So I decided that I would try my hand at copying Vance L. Simpson's eLisp code into a new version of screenplay.el that would then provide me with transitions. I spent about a day on it, and I did, you know, that horrible style of coding where you kind of look at it, and you look at it, and you look at it, and then you copy a block, and you paste it into your new version, and then you kind of see what breaks, and then you do it all over again. It's not a particularly, you know, it's not really anything to be proud of, per se, but I have to say that the end result totally works. So I used mostly the slugline code. There was code in it in the thing for sluglines, obviously, and I looked at that, and primarily I copied that example in order to get transitions. And I actually learned quite a lot while doing this because, well, it turns out that I didn't actually know that there was a database of names and locations being kept. And actually there is, or not a, I guess it's a database. It's a history list anyway. And this history list is great. You can enter names or locations, and then when you go to enter a new name or a new location, that's kind of being stored in the mini buffer, and you can arrow through previous versions so that, because, I mean, you wouldn't believe how frequently you're writing and you forget how you spelled the character's name or the exact name of that location. Was it City Street or was it just Street? Was it Small Bohemian Cafe or was it just Bohemian Cafe? You know, you can never remember that sort of thing. So having the memory, the history list in there really, really helps. So I learned about that. And of course I gave a transition, created a transition history. And for that I'm not going to do an eLisp tutorial here because I don't have any idea what I did. But you just define a variable, I guess, called screen-transition-history. And I don't know how it knows to assign that to, like, the arrow keys and stuff like that. You know, these things I don't really understand, but you do make a local variable called the screen transition history, and then you define some functions. And these functions are really interesting too, and they're almost understandable. You basically say that you're going to define a function called the screen trans margins, for instance, and that's where you set the left margin to a certain amount. And since it's all plain text, you can just set it by spaces, blank spaces. So I did it as a 60 blank space indentation on the left, and then you can define a function to enter the transition into the mini buffer and to force that into being capital letters. And once you've defined all of that, then you define a function to actually insert the transition into the page. And it's a really interesting process. It was extremely educational. It wasn't anything that I could go back and repeat again because it was just such a one-time thing. But it was definitely helpful, and it really got me out of the mode of thinking, you know, the way that I think about Bash scripting is very much and probably too much of just kind of a list of things that I want the computer to do, and it's very linear that way. I've gotten a little bit out of that since I've made this patch, because I've done actually some more shell scripting, and I'm actually using ifs and cases, case statements, conditionals, I guess. I don't know if that's the right term for them, but things that don't assume that everything is going to happen exactly linear, that things need to determine some variables and then continue. So the transition patch was not just educational, but it was actually really, really functional. And you can actually submit it as a patch to the project and have not heard back anything about it. The way that you make a patch, by the way, is pretty simple. If you've ever done any change to a file that you need to then distribute to a bunch of people or a bunch of places, or if you're coding and you're doing a patch, you might already know how to do this in that case, but it's a simple command. It's just diff-c, capital B, original file, your new version of that file, redirect to mypatch.patch. So the diff statement, of course, you've probably played around with that before, where you do a diff one file and then the next file, and it shows you what's different about those files. So if you do a diff on two completely different files, you get all kinds of weird output. But if you do a diff on a file that you've just changed like one line on, then you do the diff and you get that one line back. It tells you that line is outstanding, and it'll have a little right arrow if it's on the second argument, or a left arrow if it's on the first file that you gave in the diff statement. It's very handy. Diff-c stands for context, and it tells diff to place a whole bunch of header information and some information in line about whether it's being added to something or subtracted away from something. Just kind of gives you more information on where those differences are coming from and how they're different and stuff like that. The dash B is ignoring blank lines, because the blank lines aren't really what matter in this sort of thing. It's in code like this, it's obviously the actual text that counts. The blank lines are going to be ignored anyway. Then you redirect it to, I don't know, clatu patch or transitions.patch. Now to apply that patch to screenplay.el, it's actually really simple. You simply do a patch -p1-i transitions.patch. And as long as screenplay.el is in the same directory as that patch file, then that patch file will find screenplay.el and it will patch it. If you want to ever test that without actually changing the file, which probably isn't a terrible idea, simply add dash dash dry run to that. That's patch dash dash dry dash run and then -p1-i transitions.patch. And that will do the patch, but it won't actually write the changes out. It'll just tell you if it worked or if it didn't work. So until that ever gets merged into the actual software, which, by the way, it really should. I mean, this is an important addition. It might not be perfect, I'm not really sure, but it's definitely a good thing to have in a screenplay writing application. Until it gets merged, it can be found on slackermedia.info/tools/transitions.patch. And that should add the transitions functionality to your screenplay.el. You will find it by default, just because I felt like I needed to follow the convention of screenplay.el, as tab, 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 return, which is a horrible system, I think. I really don't like that whole tab return system. It seems really confusing to me. On my own system, I just do a control C and then the letter T, and that gets me into transition mode. So take a look at my patch. Try to patch screenplay.el, see if it works. Go in, write a little bit of a screenplay, use the transition, make sure it functions, and let me know. Let's talk about more screenplay stuff now. Okay, so another screenplay tool that I've recently been using is called Screenplay Tools, or Screenplay-Tools. And it's actually, I have to admit to you, well, first before I admit, it's a great set of tools. It's fantastic command line set of tools to help you organize your script, to help you preview it, print it, format it for printing, and to get reports from it, like location reports and character reports. Because if you've ever worked, or if you've ever even thought about how to go about making a movie that's a little bit more complex than maybe, you know, one afternoon, then you realize that you need to know in advance how many characters you've got and what their names are, so that you can fill in those slots when you're casting, or what kind of locations you've got, and what you're going to actually use as those locations. Because you might have written that you need a small cafe, but do you have access to a small cafe? Are you going to build a set? Or are you going to go out and ask people out in town if you can shoot in their cafe? How's that going to get done? In order for it to get done, you need these things in lists. And you need to draw reports from the screenplay, because you're not going to take the whole screenplay and just kind of fill in by each character's name what actor you're going to use or what location you're going to use, especially if you've got other people working on it with you. You know, you might have a location manager whose job it is to find all these locations. It would be great for this person to have a script, but it would also be great for them to have a helpful report of the locations that are expected to be found. So, really important stuff, and this package, Screenplay-Tools, is, for instance, if you think about how Git or IPSec, or Core Utils is packaged. It's screenplay-tools, and within that there are about 5 different subcommands. So the confession is that I actually wrote it, and it's just a whole bunch of bash scripts. But don't let that, I mean, it's actually pretty darn good. And I'm not saying it's great by any means, because essentially what it is a text parser. And there's 2 things about that. That means that, number one, the fact that we're screenwriting in plain text is hugely significant, right? The fact that I could write, me of all people, could write a set of tools that could go in and parse this stuff and return all kinds of information, that's a huge deal to me, because I shouldn't be able to do that. But the plain text nature of this makes it actually really, really accessible. So, once again, I mean, if you ever doubted the usefulness of plain text, yet again, it's proven. The other thing about that is that I'm not a programmer. I don't know anything about text parsing. So I probably did this horribly, horribly inefficiently, and probably in some cases just flat out wrong. I know that there are a lot of little hacks in there that I'm embarrassed that they have to be there, but at the same time, you know, sitting down wanting to get a character report, all you think about is, well, is this giving me the results that I need? And to make it even worse, your source of information really is the set of screenplays that you're working with. And if it's giving you exactly what you want on that small sample, then you figure, well, okay, it's good enough. So, I mean, there are probably screenplays out there that it would fail miserably at. And I have a feeling that there are tools that I'm not using at all that could be used. I keep thinking Perl, but I don't know. So, anyway, Screenplay-Tools has a couple of different commands. The most basic one is screenplay-help, and that gives you all of the commands right there on standard out and the basic syntax of each. So I just issued that so I could remember what I've got. So there's a screenplay-build, which builds your screenplay from all the scene files that you're creating in screenplay mode. There are some conventions that I've started using myself, and so I've kind of imposed those onto the user of screenplay-tools, and that means that your screenplay consists of multiple .scp files saved into a single directory. This is something I've gotten kind of from DocBook and from all the code that I've ever seen and kind of been involved with, and that is that you modularize your screenplay. And that seems to make sense, and I don't know that screenplay writers would really know to do that. So I think that, again, in terms of free software workflow, I think this is distinct. But I think it's actually really good, because it's not uncommon for a screenplay writer to decide, let's take this scene that happens at the very end and move it to the beginning. So we'll start with the end and then we'll show the movie how we got there. That's a very common trick. It's not usually done from the first draft. Sometimes it is, but a lot of times it isn't. And so there's a lot of moving around of scenes. It's and not just the last scene to the first. It actually happens a lot more often than you'd think. Sometimes really important informational scenes, you just realize after you've written the whole screenplay that it should happen much, much later in the movie, or it shouldn't happen at all, or it should happen really early without any context, and then it'll become clear as the rest of the movie progresses. All kinds of things like that. So a lot of people consider this a note card view, and if you go into Celtics, the screenwriting application that is available for 32-bit Linux, I think they have, if I recall correctly, they have a note card view where you can look at you can kind of zoom out and look at all your scenes, and you can grab them and move them around. So it's very, very common. All the proprietary screenplay applications have that sort of functionality. You're paying upwards of $200 for it. If you just write it as separate scenes yourself, you get it for free. That's a convention that I've started using, and I'm sticking to it, so I'm assuming other people will do that. And in order to see your script then as a complete entity, I have screenplay-build that will concatenate all the SCPs in the source directory that the user can define. So the syntax is screenplay-build directory. So you define the directory full of .scp files, screenplay-build concatenates them all together, adds a little bit of a left margin, and dumps it into a file called preview.screenplay, and you're free to look at it. It's a quick little easy command, obviously. It consists essentially of a cat and a sed script that indents the margin on the left side to make it pretty. Very simple, very basic, not a big deal. Screenplay-title is a little bit more complex, and it's just about as helpful, actually. So screenplay title pages are very specific. They've got the title all in capital letters at a certain point in the page. It's got two spaces and then the word by, B-Y, and then another space, and then the author's name. And then down in the right corner, they've got the author's name and contact information. That's important stuff. Again, it's one of those things that if it's not done that way, people reading the screenplay, if they've ever seen screenplays before, they kind of lose confidence right away because that screenplay title page doesn't look right. It's stupid, and depending on who you're dealing with, that may or may not matter, but that is a concern for most screenplay writers. So I did a screenplay-title, and this is, again, probably really, really badly done. It's a whole bunch of echoes, and then there's one little sed line in there that takes the input where the person has put in the title, and it makes it all capital, and it dumps it back out onto the command line. It dumps it into the title page. And then it does some more echoes of blank lines, and then inserts the title again, or the author's name again, and the contact information. So it's really, really slow for what it's doing. I'm sure that there's a better way to do it, like some kind of ed command or sed command that says, hey, insert X number of blank lines and now do this, and then insert X number of blank lines again. I'm sure there's a way to do that. I might even look into it and improve it, but for now, it works. It creates a nice, pretty title page that will get you a properly formatted title page fairly quickly, and a lot easier than doing it yourself. Again, this is something that proprietary screenplay writing applications actually have. They generally actually have a separate title page, so it's a little title page generator of its own, GUI, and it works, and it does its job. And it's not uncommon for a screenwriter to know that they have to do some separate step for their title page. Okay, next is screenplay-print. Now this one is really interesting because of all the ones that are in here, it's got a lot more flexibility than any of the other ones do. Screenplay-print will take a flag and an input directory. So the script itself is fairly complex because it has to determine whether the first argument is a flag or not. And if it's a flag, then it continues in one direction. If it's not a flag, then it assumes it must be a directory and it goes in another direction. So it's a pretty, for me, advanced script, and it is nice to have that flexibility. And the idea behind it is that it's going to do exactly what screenplay build did, except that it's going to add into the mix the title page, it's going to number the scenes, it's going to put form feeds and a header into it, and then it's either going to send it to the default line printer, if you have one, or if you use the no print flag. Yes, I thought it was kind of funny and cool to have a screenplay-print with a flag of --no-print. But if you use that flag, then it doesn't actually send it to the line printer. It simply saves it as a digital file, which you can then convert with text to PDF, if you want. Now you see what I was looking for that program for, and then you can just print it at your leisure later, or you can email it to people, whatever your idea, whatever your goal is. So it's a really neat little shell script. I highly recommend looking at it if you're interested in shell scripting, and I might even talk a little bit about the if statements in it and stuff like that in a moment here. Screenplay location, and the cool thing about screenplay print actually too is that it auto-detects the title and the author for the header, so that's kind of cool. That was a neat little feature. And then it confirms with the user as to whether it auto-detected it correctly. So screenplay-location is also an interactive command. You type in screenplay-location, give the destination of what where you want your report to end up, and it goes through your script and parses all the slug lines. Pulls out all the slug lines, it sorts them by uniqueness, and then you've got a couple of different options, whether you want all of the unique locations, if you want all of the interiors only, all of the exteriors only, or if you want just a literal list of all the locations in the order that they appear with repetition and everything in the script. The cool thing about this is that if you define a destination file with the extension of .org, then you end up with a location file, a location report that is compatible with org mode in Emacs. And if you've ever heard Charles Olson from Mintcast talk about org mode, he's a big fan of it. He uses it all the time. I've been using it lately a little bit here and there, and it is really nice, and I can see how our production office, even if that production office is you, could really use org mode to organize and plan out their entire shoot. So having it drop into the outline view of org mode, where you can actually make little notes about each location and maybe suggest ideas and keep track of contact information for who owns the location and stuff like that, seems like a really cool thing to have, so I wrote that into it. And then screenplay-characters, the same thing as location. Again, it you give it the input file, the output file, and it spits out all the characters that you have in your script that speak. This is the worst one of them all. It's the one that I'm embarrassed the most by. It's really bad code. It just goes in and literally finds all the capital letters. And if it's a word with capital, with that's all caps, then it yanks it out of the screenplay and dumps it into a file. Now, in between those two steps, I managed to get rid of all the slug lines. I managed to get rid of all the transitions, or at least all the common transitions. I mean, if someone's using something like slam cut, which is like one of those things that you see in screenplays that you know was never written by a professional because no one ever says slam cut except like film students. But if you're using that, then it's going to slip through. If you're using the word okay with a capital O and the capital K, that'll probably slip through. Just random capitalized words are going to slip through because I don't have a good way of saying don't grab those things. So I know that there's got to be some kind of thing where you can compare like the previous line, the current line, and then the next line, and if the previous line is either blank or, well, if it's blank and then the current line consists only of capital letters and then the next line consists of dialogue, which would just be normal capitalized. It would contain lowercase stuff. If that happens, then it's probably almost assuredly a dialogue, a character's name. If anything else is true, then we could probably zap it and not list it. That would probably help, but I don't know how to do that sort of thing. I know, I'm sure that Sed or Awk can do that, but I just don't know how to do it. So, but like extras and stuff like that, they're not going to get identified, obviously. But then no software application that does this sort of thing identifies extras. There's just no way to do that unless we come up with some metadata for scripts. But that just sounds like too much stuff to keep track of as a screenwriter. So it works. It definitely works. It gets a lot of false positives, but I prefer to err to get more false positives rather than start not getting important characters that you need to cast for. And because your stupid screenplay-tools thing on Linux didn't identify it for you, you forget to cast for it until the last minute. So having more rather than less is a good thing. So that's screenplay-tools. You can, of course, find it online. It's obviously GPL3 for whatever it's worth. And it's at gatorius.org/screenplay-tools. So I invite you to look at it. It's actually, it's come a long way in a in a short time. It's being used. I mean, I'm using it in the real world, so it's obviously robust enough to actually work. I'm not saying that that doesn't mean that there are a lot of improvements that could be made to it. If you're just a real pro at text parsing and stuff like that, let me know, and feel free to improve and send me patches or whatever, or if you commit access or whatever you need. So let's go on a coffee break, and then we'll talk about the other things that I wanted to talk about. Yes, all this screenplay writing has made me very, very thirsty for coffee. I'm sure hearing about it has also made you thirsty for coffee, so grab a cup and come right back. Okay, so some just really quick little bash tricks. I don't feel qualified enough to do a whole other tutorial on bash scripting like I did for the intro to bash scripting, but just some tricks to know about. So one of them is the read from, getting input from the user. This is easily done with the read command. So if you do echo, for instance, enter title, and then the next line you say read, all capitals, title. What will happen? And you can try this in a shell. What will happen at that point is that the script will run, it will say echo, enter your title, and then it will drop to a blank line with a cursor. And the user can input a title, and then within that shell script, that user input is being stored in a variable called title. So as a third line for that little shell script, you could, for instance, echo your, quote, double quote, your screenplay title is, space, end double quote, and then the dollar sign, and then the word title, all in caps. Now, if you run that, it will echo, enter your title, it will ask you, you can enter your title, and then it will say, your title is, and then it will spit back out at you whatever you just entered. This is obviously really, really handy for things that you require user input about, so making your shell scripts a little bit more flexible. On my new job here, one of my duties is to install lots of new software on lots of different computers, and since they're, let's say, Unix-based computers, to use their marketing slogan, I can do shell scripts. So I wrote a shell script, and one of the choices in it, because I realized that there were some updates to computers that some would need, some wouldn't. So I wanted to give the person operating the shell script the choice. Should they do the update, or should they only do the additional installs that we need to do? Pressing 1, it will echo. It will say, do you need to do an update, an OS update on this computer? You can press 1 for or Y for yes, N for no, and then it can go in either direction. Now, you're probably thinking, well, how do you get it to go into either direction? Because all we've done is we've done an input, but how does the shell script know which way to go? Glad you asked. That can be done with an if statement. So ifs are really cool, and I guess I'm going to call them conditionals. I don't know if that's the right word or not, but let's call them a conditional statement. So it's if, then, else, and then you close if with a backwards if, F-I. Really strange. But an if statement, you can do something, for instance, like if, and then square bracket, space, double quote, capital X, dollar sign, title, close, or actually, let's use my little update example, right? So let's say that we say, do you want to do the OS update, Y or N? And we then do a read from the user. So read, choice, all capitals, choice. And now we could say, if square bracket, double quote, capital X, dollar sign, choice, close quote. So we're saying if the value of choice, for instance, equals, double quote, capital X, N, close quote, close bracket. So we've just said if the value of choice turns out to be a lowercase n, or you could do a capital N and a lowercase n, and I think that would take either a capital or a lowercase n. And then you do the word then. Then install this software. Else, run the update, and then you end that loop or that branch with fi to close the little if loop. Now, that's not exactly the best way of doing it, because then we're assuming that just because they don't need the update, they don't need anything else, which is not true. But that's the basic idea. And if you look at screenplay tools, specifically at like Screenplay Print, that's got a lot of choices in it, and it uses the if, then, and else in a more mature way, where it says if the value of this thing is this flag, then let's do such and such. And actually, I just did a change to Screenplay Character that uses the same same kind of idea. I needed to identify whether there was a title page on the script, because if there's a title page, then screenplay-character was going to pick up the title, because the titles are always capitalized. And so it would absolutely religiously pick up all kinds of information on the title page. And I thought, well, it would be a lot easier if we could just identify whether there was a title page, and if there is, we could do one thing, and if there isn't, we could do another. So what I did was I said, look, you know, print out line 23, I think it is. And I did that with said, and it was said space dash in space single quote 23p for print end single quote. So get the, you know, get whatever's on line 23. So now we assign that to a variable of capital BY, by. And then we say, if the value of by is the word by, all lowercase, because that's hard-coded into screenplay title, then set the value of look to tail-in plus 56, which is simply telling that's a command that says, show me the entire document except the first 56 lines of it, because I knew that the title page was 56 lines. Else, look equals cat, and then end the if statement. So now we've got a value of look, and if there was a title page, it's the value of look is tail-in plus 56, and if it was not a title page present, then we have a look value of cat. Okay? Easy enough. Then you go into your actual task of pulling out the character names. And the way that I did that was simply issue the command $look on print.screenplay and grep for this and grep for that and sort this way and send it out to the destination file. So that's a great example of how to use if and then statements and get different results and yet run the whole script the same way anyway. So try some if statements. They're definitely powerful, and they make your shell script a lot more interactive and stuff. You can also do a case statement. And I should probably just stop for a moment and say, for real examples of how shell scripts are written, look at like BashPotter, MashPotter, and SBOPKG probably. Haven't even looked at the code of that myself. Problem with those things for me is that they're so darn complex, or they seem so darn complex, that it's almost overwhelming. So I humbly submit, if you look at my shell scripts, they're fairly bite-sized. And if you're new to it, like I am, then looking at mine, while they might not be the best examples of how to do things, because I feel like a lot of this stuff is hacks, it does kind of, you could probably follow the logic and kind of get a sense for how to make your shell scripts a little bit more interactive, because that, these scripts certainly are, and they're fairly flexible as well. They're, especially the print shell script, it will take arguments and flags, and it will differentiate between the two, so you can really do a lot just by kind of ifing and casing statements, and it's kind of cool. And by the way that you get to do a shell script plus some argument is that in Bash, and maybe other shells too, I'm not 100% sure, but there's this convention that there's your command, and then whatever comes after the command is automatically assigned the value, the variable, of $1. And then there's the command argument. So that second argument would be $2, and so on. So for screenplay-print, for example, I have arg equals $1 and opt equals $2. I could have just as easily called them arg1 equals $1 and arg2 equals $2. And then I could go through and say, okay, so if arg equals no print, then do this set of things. If arg does not equal no print, then do another set of things. So it's a cool way to get, they actually feel and look like real Unix commands then, because you can actually say screenplay-print without this option and from this directory. Or you can simply say screenplay-print from this directory. And for what it's worth, $@ is the whole set of commands. So it's really pretty neat. I don't think that's the exact correct way of doing it, but in small shell scripts, where you only have maybe one option, you know, that option's either on or off, it's a way to get it done. You know, as your shell scripts get more complex, one of the things that I've found is that at some point when something errors out, you don't want the shell script to continue running. That's one of the things here at the job that I've got right now that I was experiencing. I would write these shell scripts, and one of the steps would fail miserably, or some condition would not be met. And rather than being able to say, hey, I can't continue here and actually do the rest of the things that you've asked me to do, the shell script would just keep running. And to any user, even an experienced one, it kind of looks like the shell script ran, because, I mean, it did. It just failed, but it keeps running. And that's by design. In Unix, of course, one of the Unix philosophy items is to be quiet. Don't be verbose on errors. Don't interrupt on errors. Keep going. So one of the things that you can program into your shell script, and that actually, you know, obviously the idea of yes, continue even if there's an error, I mean, that's great. That's a good thing, because there maybe you don't want the thing to error out just on one failure, because you want to get as much done as possible. But that simply means that it's up to you to decide when things actually break. So one of the things, for instance, I used an if statement and decided that, okay, if a certain argument is missing, in this case a title page, because if we're going to print, you need a title page. So I say that if there's no title page in the source directory, then issue this error, and I echo an error, and it says you must generate a title page first, use screenplay-title, and then run this command again. Then I can do an exit space 1. Now that's something I learned from Slack building, actually, and exit 1 simply means that if we're in this loop, if we're in this little if statement, then something's horribly wrong, because title page returned blank. There was no title page in the directory, so exit, and it stops. It won't run the rest of the command. It's a really, really helpful trick, and it's just something that I've started integrating into all my shell scripts now, because, like I say, previously my shell scripts would just keep running and running and running. Whether they were actually doing what I had asked them to do or not, they were just running and running. So it's really nice to have a catch safe in there to detect that something's horribly wrong and to refuse to continue under that condition. Couple of things I want to mention. Altered Egos, which is altredegos.com, is something I've mentioned before, actually, but I just thought I would mention it again because it's been going strong. It's a cool little comic book podcast, and I'm not an expert on comic books. I do like comic books, though. I love a good comic book or a good graphic novel. I'm totally into it. So you should definitely check this one out. It's really, really cool. There's just a lot of discussion going on about all the different comic books out there. The really neat thing about it is that they've got a couple of different ways that you can actually listen to the podcast. It's really cool. There's Altered Ego Noobcast for people like me who not really all that knowledgeable about comic books, but interested in them nevertheless. And then there's the Geek Cast, which is the advanced version of that. And then there's like a Hero Cast, and then the Shot Cast, and then there's the Cube Cast, which basically has the whole shebang. It's a really well done show. You gotta listen to it. The most recent one was their Valentine's Day episode. They had their wives or girlfriends or whatever on there, so that was really fun. So yeah, check that out. It's really a great little show. I like it a lot. Doug, a friend of mine, an internet friend of mine, listener of the show, has taken the, remember the very, I think it was like probably the first Bash tutorial that I did back when I really kind of knew what I was talking about, and I had this, it was a for loop or something, and I thought it would be cool if someone could, you know, give the Python version of that. I thought that might be informative. Well, Doug has done that, and I think he'd already done that, and I'd linked to his code on the site anyway, or maybe that was someone else. Well, anyway, Doug has made a Python version of, or rather, Doug has done a Hacker Public Radio episode responding to that in some way. I haven't actually heard the HPR episode because when I'm recording this, it hasn't come out yet, but be on the lookout for that. I know that his first name is Doug. I don't know how much of the rest of his name I'm supposed to say. It's Python. It should be an interesting episode because this guy keeps emailing me random Python tips and stuff like that, and clearly knows a little bit something about Python. Whether he can explain it or not, we'll find out. But it should be interesting, so keep your ear on Hacker Public Radio for that one. Linux Fest's coming up. Indiana Linux Fest coming up in March. Northeast Linux Fest coming up in April, and then there's MagnetCon coming up in May. Those are the three that are coming up pretty darn soon, and they're all first-time fests. Wow. So first-time fests are an interesting beast, the little that I know about them so far. But they're those kinds of things that they're just the hardest thing to do, you know, ever. You're asking people to come a long way, possibly, to your festival, and you've never done a festival before. No one knows. It's kind of like one of those things, well, are any cool people going to be there? Is anyone else going to be there? Well, I shouldn't go because no one else will be there. And then it's kind of like, well, yeah, if no one else goes, then certainly there's no one going to be there. So I think it's kind of important, in a very sort of non-important way, to support first-year fests. I think that they're brave. They're really, really brave things to do. It's that horrible, horrible anxiety of throwing a party and wondering if anyone's going to show up. And so you're like, well, I should probably only get one bowl of chips and dip because, you know, not that many people are going to show up. But then you kind of like, well, maybe I should get two chips and dips because what if a lot of people show up? So it's tough. It really is. It's hard. I mean, if you've ever thrown any kind of party, you know the anxiety that goes into making it happen, trying to figure out how many resources you should expend on it and how much you can actually afford. And there's just so much that goes into it. So I think if you've got the wherewithal to get to one of these fests, I think it's, or all three of them, I think it would be really fun. And I think that if we want more things to go to, I think we should probably go to the things that kind of pop up and let these events know that, yes, we want you to continue. We want you to be here. Because I have to admit that great span between OLF, from the end of OLF to the beginning of OLF, it's such a long time. And now there's Self to kind of break up that monotony. But, I mean, isn't that still not quite enough? So, a couple more fests. I think it'll be a cool thing. I think it'll be really fun. And as always, it'll be informative, and you'll be around people who talk about the same geeky things that you do. Okay, let's see. Really quick, like E17. There's an Enlightenment 17 Slack build on slackadelic.com/thrice. Thrice is a guy who's been popping up in Oddcast Planet lately, the IRC channel. I knew him from Slackware channel, so when he popped up there, I was really sort of unsettled, but turns out he's a really great guy, and he's got this E17 Slack build, which is really, really cool. Definitely worth checking out if you're running Slackware, and you should be. It will literally grab all the latest source from the Enlightenment 17 SVN, pull it down, make them into little packages, and then help you install them. It's not SBOPKG, understand. This is a Slack build that you have to do the old-fashioned way. You need to download the Slack build. I just did a wget on the whole directory. wget --mirror, whatever directory it was. I think it was slackadelic.com/thrice E17, I think. Grab that, do the Slack, you know, read the readme, do the Slack building, and then change directory into, I think it goes into /temp, if I recall correctly, and actually install those packages. And there's a couple of other things that you have to do to fix some menu issue and some other things. Really, really cool Slack builds, and then E17 is just looking better than ever. It's very impressive, period. I mean, it's just, if you look at that thing, some of the things that they're doing are just, I mean, it just looks so darn polished. It's just so nice. Attention to detail all over the place. Enlightenment was, I think, probably the first, not E17, but Enlightenment in general was the first Unix desktop that I got running back on my Mac OS days. So E17 on a netbook is really, really nice. It looks really great. I've got Slackware with E17 on my Acer Aspire 1 right now, and I've been really enjoying it. Highly recommend that you check out both the Slack builds themselves, just because they're well done, but also Enlightenment 17, because they're neat. MAMO is still no more, and Nokia is doing Windows phones now. That's about the gist of it. That's about all there is to say about it, to be honest. So there you go. There's my statement on MAMO. All right, I think that's about everything for this episode. I don't know how long it's been going on, but that is everything. So thanks for listening, and this has been the GNU World Order, Episode 8, Season 6. I'm Klaatu. You can find me on the internet at oddcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. You can find me via IM at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can find me on IRC on the Free Node Network in the channel Oddcast Planet or Autour or Slacker Media. You can find me via email at notklaatu@member.fsf.org. Thanks for listening, and I will talk to you next time.
Pressing something when you squeeze.